selling memoir Solito, also unaccompanied, a collection of poems about his experience migrating to the United States as a 9-year-old child to reunite with his parents. Javier has been a Stegner Fellow at Stanford and a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard, and holds fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Poetry Foundation as well. We're going to interview him in Spanish after the broadcast, and we're going to post it on our Spanish website. You can go to democracynow.org and click right through. That does it for our program. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Gozder, Masai Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanjit Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Support for this program comes from KPBU members and from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information for the May special election at lwvpdx.org. The website has explanations of ballot measures on services for renters and for children and public safety. The League informs voters because every vote matters.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kotek puts a pause on I-205 tolling.
A new report shows over 40% of Oregon households struggled to make ends meet in 2021.
And in national news, extreme weather in the U.S. has a high price tag.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 10th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek orders Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT, to pause its toll collection plans until at least 2026. This comes after pushback from state legislators, over ODOT plans to toll two stretches of Interstate 205 in Clackamas County. Clackamas County Democrats introduced House Bill 3614 to prohibit tolling on state highways until 2026. ODOT plans to use tolling funds for several major expansion projects for the I-205 and I-5 freeways in Portland. Construction on I-205 at the Abernathy Bridge has already begun, and ODOT plans expansions on I-5 at the Rose Quarter and the Interstate Bridge between Portland and Vancouver. Currently, a significant portion of ODOT's budget comes from state and federal motor fuels taxes, which are projected to decrease with the increased usage of electric vehicles. ODOT says the cost of tolls will vary based on the time of day, though neither the prices nor the time of day tolls would shift has been determined. Critics note that expanding highway capacities does not reduce traffic and may instead worsen congestion. They recommend congestion pricing as a means of reducing traffic without necessitating expansion.
The drama continues in the Oregon legislature. We're in day 8 of the Republican walkout, and now Oregon House Speaker Dan Rayfield has asked State Representative Brian Stout to resign. This comes after a Columbia County judge upheld a restraining order against Stout. A former campaign volunteer filed a 5-year restraining order against Stout, alleging that he sexually assaulted her and threatened her life. Representative Stout is a Republican who was elected to represent District 31 last fall. That district includes Columbia County and parts of rural Washington County. Columbia County Circuit Court Judge Kathleen Callahan upheld the restraining order against Stout on Tuesday. In House Speaker Rayfield's statement, he wrote, quote, "The behavior described in the judge's order does not align with the values of the House of Representatives. I no longer believe that he can effectively serve and should therefore resign. Whether he makes that decision or not, he will remain without any committee assignments," end quote. It isn't clear if Stout will heed the calls to give up his seat.
It's the 7th day the Republican state lawmakers in Oregon have walked off the job. At stake are a number of legislative priorities, including bills on gun control, abortions, and gender-affirming care. A coalition of advocacy groups plan to rally on Thursday at 5 p.m. at the state capitol. They're calling attention to the fact that the issues the Republican lawmakers are walking out about are broadly agreed upon by Oregonians, and that some 68% of Oregon voters approved Measure 113, which disqualifies members from re-election if they have more than 10 days of unexcused absence during the legislative session. KBOO's Althea Billing spoke with Blair Stenvik from Basic Rights Oregon to learn more.
So Basic Rights Oregon and others are rallying tomorrow at the state capitol about Oregon State Republicans walking out. Why rally? Talk to me.
Right. Well, first, I just want to emphasize that we had a vote on this last year, and Oregonians showed by more than 2/3% voting in favor of Measure 113, which limits was intended to limit walkouts. It shows that really the majority, more than the majority of the Oregonians, want their government to function properly and go to work. You know, so we're rallying with a really broad coalition of organizations supporting LGBTQ plus rights, reproductive health and abortion rights, gun safety, housing and homelessness, teachers. So just a wide range of issues of folks who, you know, want all of our lawmakers to do the work that they were elected to do. We understand that some lawmakers have differing political opinions, but that doesn't mean that they can halt the entire process and push back on the will of the voters. So we're really just hoping to, you know, urge these senators to get back to work, the work that, you know, they're supposed to be doing for all their constituents.
What are the issues that have Republican state lawmakers walking out of session?
Right. So I think looking at different statements that Senate Minority Leader Tim Knope has made in the media, it seems like there are two bills that they're pretty focused on. One is a gun safety bill, and we'll have someone speaking at the rally tomorrow about that. Another is a bill that we're supporting along with Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon and ACLU of Oregon, House Bill 2002, which will add in some protections and increase access for both abortion and gender-affirming care for trans folks. This bill was formulated after the overturning of Roe v. Wade last year in an attempt to protect our healthcare providers from government overreach and allow, you know, Oregon values to remain in Oregon law and increase access to healthcare, even as across the country, trans healthcare and abortion are being attacked.
Yeah, significant bills. What can folks expect at the rally tomorrow?
Folks can expect, you know, we're going to have folks representing a wide range of issues there. We're going to have a lineup of speakers who represent different communities that are negatively impacted when legislation gets halted and Republicans walk out. You know, we'll have people of color. We'll have folks, you know, who do hard labor. We'll have folks who work in housing and homelessness. LGBTQ people who work in abortion advocacy. Yeah, we'll be at the South Steps, the state capitol at 5 p.m., and we're hoping to really bring some energy to the capitol. And, you know, in addition to pressuring Republicans to come back, we really want to show some gratitude to the lawmakers who are, you know, remaining in the building and holding steadfast to the values that Oregonians elected them on.
Now, this isn't the first time that Republican lawmakers have walked out. And in looking at this now, do you find, I mean, in the work that you do, that there are misconceptions about the role of walkouts or what that means for our legislative process?
Right. I mean, I think the biggest thing to highlight right now is just that, you know, as you said, walkouts have impacted some really crucial legislation before. And Oregonians showed, right, by 65%, and 34 out of 36 counties voted in favor of Measure 113. Specifically aimed at ending these walkouts, or at least, you know, limiting them to only 10 days. And so I think, you know, some Republican senators, I think they think that they're representing their constituents by walking out. But the truth is that even in a lot of those redder districts, people want their lawmakers to get to work.
Do you have any final thoughts for us before we wrap up?
You know, just we're seeing a lot of anti-democratic actions from state legislatures across the country right now. I think both, you know, Tennessee and Montana have recently worked to silence legislatures who speak up on issues like you know, advocating for people of color, for gun safety, for trans rights. And Republicans, by walking out and denying a quorum, you know, and walking out on the majority party that Oregonians elected, they're also, you know, engaging in anti-democratic actions. And, you know, we believe that if they choose to continue walking out after those 10 days of excused absences are up, they will face ramification of their jobs again. And so we really encourage them to come back to work and be in their arena rather than running away from it.
That was Blair Stenvik of Basic Rights Oregon speaking with me about a rally planned for Thursday, May 11th at 5 p.m. at the Oregon State Capitol. A coalition of advocacy groups are calling on Republican state lawmakers to return to session. They're currently on day 7 of their walkout. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
A new report says about 44% of households in Oregon struggled to make ends meet in 2021. That's according to United Ways of the Pacific Northwest and its research partner, United for Alice. The report focused on people who make more money than the federal poverty level, but less than what they need to financially survive day to day. That category is known as ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. The report found that households headed by single females experienced some of the highest rates of hardship, with about 78% unable to afford the basics. United Way hopes state lawmakers can use the data to better help underserved families. They want better services for child care and housing, areas that were already in crisis even before the pandemic. One option is tax breaks, like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which helps low-income workers. Jim Cooper is the president and CEO of United Ways of the Pacific Northwest. He said, quote, "It's also really important to point out that a lot of these families never really recovered from the Great Recession. And so this is a population that's been growing since 2009 or so at a pretty significant level across the state," end quote.
In March of 2022, ambulances responded on time to more than 87% of life-threatening calls in the Multnomah County's urban areas. By February of this year, that number had fallen to 68%. Officially, an ambulance is on time when it arrives within 8 minutes. The county's ambulance contract with American Medical Response, or AMR, is up for renewal this year. The county is considering reforms in its ambulance policy, including triaging low-priority calls and sending out basic life support ambulances staffed with emergency medical technicians, not paramedics. AMR has long wanted the county to change its usual policy of requiring two paramedics to staff each ambulance.
Debt ceiling negotiations remain at a standstill after a White House meeting. More reaction to former President Donald Trump being found liable for sexual abuse and defamation. And Texas could raise the age to buy semi-automatic weapons. With more on those stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Everybody in this meeting reiterated the positions they were at. I didn't see any new movement.
House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said following Tuesday's White House meeting with President Joe Biden, congressional leaders from both sides of the aisle were unwilling to compromise in debt limit negotiations. The meeting comes just over a week after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen told lawmakers the U.S. will run out of tools to pay trillions of dollars in debt by June 1st. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries said McCarthy still has not taken defaulting on the national debt off the table, which he called reckless, irresponsible, and extreme.
America must always pay our bills. A default would be catastrophic for everyday Americans, for small businesses, for people all across the land.
Congressional leaders are set to reconvene with President Biden again on Friday. A federal jury found former President Donald Trump sexually abused and defamed E. Jean Carroll, a writer who accused Trump of raping her in a dressing room in the mid-90s. Although Trump has been accused of sexual assault by more than 24 women, Tuesday's verdict marks the first time he's faced legal consequences. Trump's attorney, Joe Tacopina, told CNN they're ready to proceed and go forward.
Strange verdict. This was a rape claim. It was a rape case all along, and the jury rejected that, but made other findings. So we'll obviously be appealing those other findings.
New York Representative George Santos has been criminally charged by federal prosecutors in New York. The exact nature of the charges are still unknown, but the Republican lawmaker accused of being dishonest about his background could appear in federal court as soon as this week. A Texas House committee advanced a measure Monday to raise the minimum age to buy semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21. Two Republicans joined Democrats in an 8-5 committee vote. Before the House convened on Monday, advocates made their voices heard at the Texas Capitol. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has said he believes the measure to be unconstitutional. Finally, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed three bills into law Monday, which intend to mitigate the influence of the Chinese government in the Sunshine State. The measures will prohibit land ownership in Florida by Chinese citizens, ban the use of popular Chinese-owned social media platforms like TikTok and WeChat on government devices, and limit colleges and universities from building relationships with foreign countries of concern like China.
So today, Florida makes it very clear, we don't want the CCP in the Sunshine State. We want to maintain this as the free state of Florida, and that's exactly what these bills are doing.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, about the spring anthology issues of the paper. At 6, it's the Magical Mystery Tour. Then at 7, the Global Sale. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, sunny with a high of 74. Today in history, in 1869, the first transcontinental railroad across the United States is completed at Promontory Summit, Utah Territory, and finished with a golden spike. The quote of the day is from American writer Shel Silverstein, who died today in 1999. Silverstein, along with his beloved children's short poems, also penned Johnny Cash classic, A Boy Named Sue. He wrote, quote, "Listen to the mustn'ts, child. Listen to the don'ts. Listen to the shouldn'ts, the impossibles, the won'ts. Listen to the never-haves, then listen close to me. Anything can happen, child. Anything can be."
It's getting closer to the end of the Supreme Court's term, and House Democrats, including Representative Mary Peltola, are worried the court will overturn the Indian Child Welfare Act, known as ICWA. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez and National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Congresswoman Mary Peltola and other House Democrats say they're worried the U.S. Supreme Court is about to weaken the Indian Child Welfare Act to the detriment of Native children and their tribes. Peltola, the first Alaska Native person elected to Congress, previously worked as a tribal court judge, where child custody cases were a mainstay. At a congressional roundtable Tuesday, Peltola stressed the importance of keeping children with their families or placing them within their tribe.
I think for every single human group ever in existence, children are precious. Children are our future. And certainly for natives, it is no different.
The Supreme Court is expected to rule soon on a challenge to ICWA brought by the state of Texas and a group of non-native adoptive parents. They say the Indian Child Welfare Act makes unconstitutional distinctions based on race. Supporters of ICWA say it's based on tribal affiliation. Congress passed the law to reverse the wholesale alienation of children from their tribes. New York University law professor Maggie Blackhawk says the trend reached terrifying levels by the 1950s and 60s.
State government separated over 100,000 of the estimated 400,000 Native children from their parents and placed those children in homes with no political, cultural, or linguistic connection to their nations.
The case is called Brackeen versus Holland. The justices heard arguments in November. A ruling is expected by the end of June. For nearly two decades, a North Dakota county elected local commissioners in a way that did not comply with a consent decree concerning Native American interests. Advocates say a settlement has been reached to ensure a fair system is reestablished. Mike Moen reports.
The Native American Rights Fund recently announced the pending agreement with Benson County. In 2000, a court order, spurred by a Department of Justice filing, said the county's choice of an at-large election process diminished the political power of natives in the area. But in 2004, the county went back to that process. NARF attorney Michael Carter says recent census figures show natives deserve greater representation.
The county had a majority Native American population. However, there was only one Native American serving on the board.
The group, which represented the Spirit Lake Tribe, contends the county's actions violated the Federal Voting Rights Act. The Benson County State's attorney calls the settlement a good result. He notes that in 2004, the commission responded to a shift in Native population numbers and didn't think the original decree was permanent. In a phased-in structure, the new agreement gives Native voters an opportunity to elect three candidates of their choice to the Benson County Board of Commissioners. Carter says cases like this one stem from a project NARF launched in 2020 to work with tribes around the country on redistricting efforts and the importance of fair political maps.
These are ongoing issues that, you know, require the local voters to stay engaged and stay informed about what county and local officials are doing.
The organization is involved in a pair of other legal cases concerning redistricting in North Dakota and its impact on Native American voters. Those lawsuits are related to legislative seats. Carter says one they filed is scheduled to go to trial in June.
That was Mike Moen. This week, Orlando Teller, a member of the Navajo Nation, was sworn in as the first ever Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of Transportation. The new position was established under the infrastructure law, creating the Office of Tribal Affairs to serve under the U.S. Transportation Secretary. Navajo leaders were among those to join Teller in Washington, D.C. for the swearing-in ceremony. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
After being denied the full freedom to vote for decades, indigenous groups are working to make access to the ballot more convenient and accessible for Native communities in Michigan. Farah Siddiqui reports.
With elections on the horizon, indigenous groups in Michigan are educating Native communities about how they can make their voices heard to make greater impact in their lives. The Rock the Native Vote campaign is helping to improve access to the ballot while building awareness about how voting can make changes in Native communities. Meredith Kennedy of Miigwech, Inc. explains that the full right to vote for Indigenous people didn't occur until just 40 years ago in 1982, and she shares that her people still face many other challenges.
Our voting place is right next to US 31, a super busy highway. I'm just letting you know it's not safe. Our communities don't have running water, where I have elders who are houseless and homeless on their own land. Till we as Indigenous people start using our vote as part of our voice, we're not going to see change.
One federally recognized tribe, Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa, has 3,800 people of voting age. About 2,600 live in Michigan, including about 800 who are not registered to vote. That means there's the potential for roughly one-third of the tribe's citizens to vote in Michigan. Rock the Native Vote encourages Indigenous Michiganders to register to vote and make a plan to vote. Meredith explains that through community-building efforts, Native people are voting both in their own sovereign nation elections and then also the greater elections. She says people like Deb Callen and Brian Newland at the Department of Interior are making a difference.
These Indigenous issues are being brought forward by the people who are also Native, who are saying, hey, we're going to do a boarding school report. And then renaming state parks and monuments that are derogatory towards Native people, like, that's huge. So I see someone making a difference in Indian country.
In 2021, the U.S. Census identified more than 60,000 people who identify as Native American in Michigan, and more than 250,000 that identify as Indigenous and another race. For Michigan News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
In the first 4 months of this year, the U.S. suffered seven different extreme weather events, each creating $1 billion or more in damages. In these seven events, as reported by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, extreme weather killed 97 people and caused more than $19 billion in damages. Between March 2nd and 3rd, at least 33 tornadoes touched down in the Southern Plains, Southeast, and Ohio Valley, killing 13 and costing over $4 billion. $1 million. Between March 31st and April 1st, at least 145 tornadoes were recorded in the central U.S., killing 33 and creating $4.3 billion in damage. A series of atmospheric rivers dumping rain and snow in California killed 22 people and cost $3.5 billion. The authors of the fourth National Climate Assessment wrote, quote, "The impacts of climate change are already being felt in communities across the country. More frequent and intense extreme weather and climate-related events, as well as changes in average climate conditions, are expected to continue to damage infrastructure, ecosystems, and social systems that provide essential benefits to communities."
The Los Angeles City Council is moving forward with a controversial plan to convert the scattergood generating station in Playa del Rey from natural gas to hydrogen. Suzanne Potter has more.
The City of Los Angeles has set an ambitious goal to run on 100% renewable energy by 2035, and part of the plan is to convert a natural gas plant to burn hydrogen instead. The City Council decided in February to dedicate $800 million to make the switch at the Scattergood Generating Station in Playa del Rey. Louis Ting is Director of Power System Engineering at the L.A. Department of Water and Power.
It's just like any combustion as far as hydrogen goes, but we got to remember that hydrogen doesn't have any carbon in it, so that's the beauty of it.
The so-called green hydrogen will be generated from clean sources like wind and solar energy. Jason Rondeau, also with the LADWP, says the plant is designed to work at the flip of a switch in case of emergency, like a wildfire or earthquake.
Over the course of the year, we use it about 20 or 30% of the time, more often than not during the summer. In the future, we estimate that we'll probably use it between 1 and 5% of the time, meaning it's rarely used, but when it's used, it's needed.
Alex Jassett, with the group Physicians for Social Responsibility in Los Angeles, says he's concerned about safety and nitrogen oxide emissions polluting the air.
What we're concerned about is the combustion of hydrogen, because that's where the NOx emissions come from. It's where a lot of the explosion and risks come from. It's where the pipelines come from.
And Theo Coretto, with the group Communities for a Better Environment, says the plant managers will need to be certain the pipes are sealed tight to keep the hydrogen contained.
It's just two atoms. It's very hard to detect once it does leak. And so we're concerned about the possibility of these leaks forming due to embrittlement and then hydrogen leaking out into our communities.
The city is hoping to complete phase one of the project by 2029. This story was produced with original reporting from Kaylee Wells at KCRW. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
It's Wednesday, and that means a visit from KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who reminds us that you can't preserve what you don't own.
200-year-old Doug firs that I watched over 40 years are gone in less than a day because the new owner wanted that, as all around town landmarks have been replaced by transit-friendly apartments and condos, bringing dozens of new residents without parking spaces. The tiny percentage of folks with the big stashes of money make changes we all have to live with. Like congressional Republicans playing chicken with the U.S. economy because their masters don't believe in government that tries to take care of its citizens, even though they could easily afford much higher taxes. What will Biden, as wealthy as any Republican, give away so he can try to be president 4 more years? One positive change is that someone managed to take Trump to court, and the man of 1,000 threatened lawsuits got sued and lost. I get no joy from Trump's suffering. I get joy from large trees and open spaces that I can't preserve because I don't own them. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 10th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Danielle Smith, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, we sure do need you. You can just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, and have a great night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, about two special editions of the paper, the Spring Anthology Part 1 and 2. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So I wanted to start by giving our listeners an overview. What is the Street Roots Spring Anthology? What can readers expect?
Yeah, so this is the second annual Spring Anthology. We started it last year. It's really a two-part anthology of some of what we feel are our most important stories from the last 12 months, from April 2022 through March of 2023. Also, you know, some poetry that was a big hit in those time frames are included in the issues, kind of a greatest hit sort of thing. And then this year, we also worked with two really talented local artists to produce the cover. That was Kalila Fuller, who produced both covers for the issues, illustrated them, and then Cass Murata, who is another local artist who currently lives in Portland, Maine, but is originally from here or spent some time here, and illustrated a beautiful back cover or back page for both the issues, all really kind of leaning on this theme of spring in Portland.
So what are some of those stories that you decided to republish?
Great question. I mean, part one, you know, we look at Melanie Henshaw, Street Roots Indigenous Affairs reporter, wrote a story when she was still an investigative reporting fellow for Street Roots on the police, the Portland police homicide of Irvin Jones in the 40s and his family's